This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Purdue University Northwest English Literature Professor Carolyn Boyarsky joined us not long ago to talk about her latest book that looks into the effects of miscommunication within organizational communications. She mentioned some models of good communications by Enbridge Pipeline Company when it began its pipeline expansion project through the town of Griffith. And she offers up some examples of miscommunication between engineers and managers prior to the 1992 Chicago flood and the BP Deepwater Horizon oil rig spill. And she talked to us and mentioned how her insights are helping writers, scientists, and engineers better inform their leaders and the community about a potential problem.
I think the biggest challenge is to help engineers or anyone writing recognize that they are writing for a reader. And this is true of electronic media as well. Mm-hmm. That it's, what does the reader, how is the reader going to respond to what you've written? And most people simply write what they want to say without thinking about the reader's response. This has become especially problematic today because we're used to just texting, we're used to tweeting, and it's a series of, I feel this way and out it comes. The problem is in professional writing, if you need some information, if you need people to do something, then you need to consider what is the information they need to know and how do you present it so they will do what you want them to do, respond to your request in the way you'd like them to do it.
In our conversation here before we went on air to talk about some of the issues that, that technical people face, we've talked here about the fact that they're really, although I know there are job titles that are still out there and people who work under them, there's no such thing as a technical writer hardly anymore, that we find people that are very technically minded kind of put in these jobs. For example, somebody who has to write information that would go into a handbook or an instruction manual for some piece of equipment, they have to certainly know the equipment well enough to be able to write about it, but it's difficult, I imagine, for them to be able to write clearly enough and so that anybody, the average person, could pick up the manual and try and understand what you're talking about.
Actually, it's the technical writer can learn about the technical field to the point where he or she can explain it because he's learned how to write so that it explains to a reader. It's the engineer or the technologist who has difficulty. One of the things they do in Caterpillar when they come out with a whole new machine is they literally tear it down in front of the writer and then put it back together so the writer can watch what they are doing so that the writer understands how the machine works. When you're dealing with engineers, they already know how it works, but they don't realize they're talking to people who don't know mm-hmm. how it works. And Enbridge, we're talking about people in the area.
Right. That was one of the examples that in your book that you bring up here. There are some examples of good communication and bad communication. And one of the examples that you mentioned of good communications was done by Enbridge Pipeline Company here in Northwest Indiana. For people that maybe are not familiar with how Enbridge fits into this, tell us first and explain how they seem to be a good example of how you can properly communicate.
When, or sometime shortly after, they had one of the worst leaks in the history of the United States of oil leaks, where over 1 million gallons had leaked out along the Kankakee River in Michigan, they began to enlarge their pipelines so that they could bring more oil down, gas down from the north up in Canada, Alaska.
And we're talking about the shale oil coming out of,
yes,
particularly
yes.
out of Canada. Yeah.
And they have a headquarters right here in Griffith,
right,
which meant that they were going to be expanding the size of their pipes by about 3 times. They were also, in doing this, there would also be a lot of trucks, a lot of traffic in the area. They needed to reassure the community of Griffith and those people who lived right around where they were located that this was safe And people were already coming from an idea of having heard about that Kankakee leak. So they put together a slide presentation in which they really were able to present what they were doing, how all of the safety features that they were putting in would work. And they explained it in a way that anyone could understand. And then they went around to a lot of the organizations in the region and talked about what they were doing, so that the community would feel safe. And it was one of the best slide presentations I've ever seen, mm-hmm. in that it explained it to the point where anyone could understand it, including this English literature major sitting here.
I know that in the years during that construction project that they put through, in not only putting in the pipes, the expanded pipeline itself, but also building entirely new tank farms on the south edge of Griffith. And in fact, you can pass those tanks on Avenue H, which is just south of the railroad tracks between Highland and Griffith to the south and west. But you see those tanks there, and that was all part of the project, I know. They had to explain why they were out there, why they were doing all that work, and why people that would drive out there all the time would have some traffic jams because of the construction crews that are out there working. It's probably not an easy task to try to explain to the average person what this complex project was all about.
Well, it's not easy, and there will always be people who will complain, but I think their presentation was one of the best I've seen in attempting to assure a community that they were taking all precautions that they could.
We're talking with Purdue University Northwest English literature professor, Carolyn Boyarsky, who has written a number of books here on communication, and in particular with business and industry, teaching people in business and industry how to better communicate, to explain to the general public in many cases what the projects are. In this particular book, we've taken up the issue of a good piece of communication with the Enbridge Pipeline Project in Indiana. And you have also some examples of miscommunication in particular in one other area in particular, and of course a nationally known bad example of miscommunication. Will you explain those, please?
Well, a very bad form of miscommunication occurred over in the Chicago flood in 1992. And I always like to talk about that because I think it is absolutely the perfect model of miscommunication. It was done in a way that it could have been totally prevented if the communication had been appropriate for the people who were involved. The flood, the hole in the tunnel walls had been discovered in January, and it was a company that had strung cables, and the company saw it, contacted the city of Chicago to let them know there was this hole in a wall. And then the city did send someone down to take a look at it. He couldn't find a parking place, so he came back. By the time they really looked at it and got someone down there, the wall was crumbling. Well, he came back, he took a couple pictures, he came back, and they had meetings and decided they now would work out how they would fix it. And eventually they sent a note to the head of that department. Well, it turns out the head of that department was new. He was acting. He was in finance, not an engineer. And they had not taken any of that into account. And so he thought this was just another piece, like a one of the potholes in Chicago, and took his time, told everybody to put out a bid for it. They did. The bid was way high, so they put out another bid. And when second bid came in, the flood occurred. Mm-hmm. Had anyone taken into consideration that this man didn't know where this flood was in the financial district and the million-dollar mile and provided him with this kind of information, he might not have put it out for bid. He might have said, go ahead and take care of the problem. But without taking into consideration who their reader was, they omitted all this information that he never did know.
That's interesting. Another one, too, I know that you mentioned in the book, too, it was a problem dealing with a very famous oil rig explosion, the BP Deepwater Horizon explosion that happened, and how there was a great deal of miscommunication about that. How did we know, of course, the outcome of that, but how did the miscommunication in that particular case come about?
That was a problem of actually taking what we do in texting and tweeting and thinking about social media and how we communicate instead of thinking this is professional. A man on the rig, one of the engineers on the rig, emailed someone on land and said, we're having a real problem. The man on the line on land, he was the manager, mm-hmm. wrote back and said, I'm sure this is a problem, but we can take care of it tomorrow. I'm going dancing tonight. That's really black humor.
It's rather tragic in many respects. Some very expensive black humor, for certainly for BP, because it cost them billions and billions of dollars to deal with the outcome of that leak.
Along with the deaths.
That's right. And there are a lot of fatalities that happened as a result,
yes.
too. One other point that you mentioned as well, we talk here about BP Deepwater Horizon, about the disaster there, but also, too, that you mentioned the Columbia space shuttle breakup in the book, too, and some miscommunication there. How did that come about?
Well, that was it couldn't have been prevented, mm-hmm. the problem, but they might have been able to get those astronauts home. There was an engineer there who recognized what the real problem was and wrote an email back to the engineers working on trying to solve the problem. If you remember, the Houston would not send a photographer, and they had no idea just how big the hole was or where it was. And when this engineer sent his email, he began something like, I know you guys are busy, and I know that sometimes I go flying off with the wrong answers, but I thought you all might want to. At this point, nobody is going to bother reading further. He eventually did hit exactly what was going to happen, somewhere around the middle of the third paragraph, which is where a lot of people put information that is what is the really necessary information. I've sort of called it third paragraph syndrome.
So if they put it up in the top of the message or even in the second paragraph, there would have been better likelihood that somebody would have seen it and taken the proper action?
First paragraph
would be better, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yes. First paragraph. If you do not put something in that first paragraph that will keep the reader's attention, the reader will not read further. We don't read word for word memos, letters, correspondence. We skim or scan them. And research shows that we do this in a T formation. We read that very first part, and then if we are going to read further, we go down the middle if it's hard copy. It's an F pattern if it's on a computer. We read across the top, we start down the left column, and then we might read a little more second paragraph if we're that interested, and then we continue down the left column skimming. So if it's stuck somewhere in the middle, you will never see it.
Do you think that we just end up needing a new procedure of being taught on how to read email messages of any kind?
No, I think we need a new procedure in how to write them.
Mm-hmm.
We are all going to read this way. So what we believe is that writers need to know how we read and then to write so that we will pick up what we read. We're too busy. There's too much out there, too much information we have to have to stop and really read things carefully. Nobody's going to do that. We have to recognize that and then begin to write so that we do provide the information, the details that people need at the beginning so that they can follow what we are trying to tell them.
That's Purdue University Northwest English Literature Professor Carolyn Boyarsky. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's find out about a way that Northwest Indiana small business gets some support these days from an organization that's called SCORE. There are chapters all across the state, and one here in Northwest Indiana in particular. And we're talking now with Jim Hubbard. He is the immediate past chapter chair and currently the secretary for SCORE's chapter here in Northwest Indiana. Jim, thanks for joining us here on the program today.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with what SCORE is, talk about the organization in general and how important it has become in Northwest Indiana.
Well, SCORE as an organization has been around since 1964. It's a subset of the Small Business Administration, although we are actually a line item in the congressional budget, believe it or not, one of the best returns on taxpayer investment ever. But anyway, we are the nation's premier, and we're the largest volunteer business mentoring organization. It started back in 1964 with the idea that people that are perhaps getting ready for retirement and are going to be leaving the workforce with all this knowledge could maybe share some of their knowledge with the people that are just coming into the workforce and coming into the business world. And that's really the basis behind it. Get people who have knowledge of business, who like to help other people, and connect them with people who need some of that advice. So that's really where it started, and it's been running for 64 years, and it's an all-volunteer organization. There are 320 chapters in the United States. Mm-hmm. There's probably, I think, at any given time, around 11,000 to 12,000 volunteers putting together 2 million hours of free mentoring service to businesses in the United States. I mean, it's a fabulous organization, really.
Well, it sounds like it's an organization that has, as you say, besides being around for a while and have so many people helping out, that they've found ways to help get business mentors to the people that probably need the help the most. And we're talking about young or beginning small business owners and operators. How long has the operation been supporting Lake and Porter and LaPorte, Newton, Jasper counties?
Well, in those five counties here, this chapter is well over 25 years old. Our oldest volunteer has been with the organization 26 years. He retired sometime during that time. He was a volunteer before that. Yeah, when you say that, but it's not always young people that are starting businesses. There are many people who, throughout their life, decide, okay, it's time for me to work for myself.
Yeah, I hesitate to call them young people necessarily, but they are young, maybe in being involved in businesses. They may work for a business, but that's different. Yeah,
that's right. They're new to the business world anyway, or at least to being their own operating their own business, and that's probably. About half of the work that we do is with people who are looking for information about how do I start my business, what do I need to do to get an EIN number, you know, how do I get myself registered, what kind of organizational structure should I have, should I be a sole proprietorship, should I be a limited liability corporation, should I be a S-Corp, all those kinds of technical things. And then we help them put together what their roadmap, and the roadmap for any business should be their formal business plan. And that's another area that we're probably best known for, in helping people put together a business plan and make sure that their business model, what they're going to offer in terms of either products or services, to whom are they going to offer them, how are they going to attract those people, how are they going to let the world know that they're there, all those kinds of things, and then how to run the business successfully are things that we spend a lot of time with. Now, there are also individuals who are in business who are having problems one or more areas of their business, whether it's a use of social media, whether it's other marketing issues or sales issues or cash flow. Again, we have a lot of people with a lot of knowledge that can help them through it. So those are the things that we get involved with, and I think that's how we help small businesses in Northwest Indiana get get up and get going, and those that are up and going to continue to be successful.
Well, you mentioned about the fact that there are so many different facets, of course, that run a business of any type, some specialized and many of them in general in nature. Can all of the business mentors that help out in the SCORE organization pretty much cover the gamut of all the needs that maybe either a new business owner or somebody who's starting one or having problems, as you say, can take advantage of?
Well, I think all of our mentors are capable of assessing what the person needs, but no, each one of us is not knowledgeable in all areas. We have people that are what we would call subject matter experts, so people that are specialists in use of social media, say, people that are marketing and sales specialists, people that are intellectual property specialists, those that have human resource experience. We have business insurance. We have access to people who are knowledgeable. So all of our mentors are able to make an initial assessment of what a client would be looking for, and then we work amongst ourselves to make sure that the people with the right backgrounds and the right experience are connected with that individual.
We're talking about Jim Hubbard, who is the immediate past chairman and currently the secretary for the Northwest Indiana SCORE chapter. There are 10 chapters in Indiana, by the way. SCORE is the big nationwide premier and the largest volunteer network of business mentors. Jim, when you talk about giving assistance to folks that need the help in a small business setting, can you give us any examples that you can think of over the years that seem to have worked out well, that you've had somebody that's had some questions, a new business owner, somebody maybe that needs a little extra help in a certain area of their business, and they've asked for help from SCORE, and the volunteers have come in and done what they can and help turn things around, so to speak?
Well, yeah, we've done a lot of work with folks that are in the service industry, and so whether it be somebody that is a home improvement contractor or somebody providing a service for folks, one of the things that happens is those are great. They want to go to work for themselves. They're very good, hardworking folks. They work like crazy. They work from morning to dusk, and then they get to the end of the month or the end of the year, and they go, geez, I didn't make any money.
Uh-huh.
And part of it is associated, they don't understand the cost to provide the services that they're doing. They thought it was simply the hours of their time and the materials that they used in the process. And it's more than that. There's this big area called overhead, which are all the other expenses associated with operating a business, from the rent of the space that you have, to the insurance that you're involved there, to the purchase of your equipment and the depreciation. And when you forget those things, then you're working off of your cash flow for providing services, and when you get to the end of the year, you don't have any money left because you didn't do a good job of understanding your total cost, therefore the pricing wasn't correct. So we've done a lot of work with folks there to help them understand their costs. Then they were better able to serve their clients by, I guess, pricing things better that would, you know, make sure they are around and continue business. So I would say in the service industry, we've done an exceptional job. Helped some retailers, and of course, retail is a tough situation now.
Yeah.
And we've helped people with cash flow understand how you have to manage your cash, with money coming in, money going out, and being how to project that into the future so you don't get caught short. Those would be some examples.
Since you have so many people who have been involved so much in business and in all kinds of business facets, working as mentors with the folks in Northwest Indiana, do you have any other relationships that you have with the business community and chambers of commerce, for example, since there are so many of them here in the region?
Glad you mentioned that. We work very closely with the Indiana Small Business Development Center, which is part of the state of Indiana, and we do similar things, but a little bit different. We can share customers. We also have a relationship with most of the chambers of commerce in Northwest Indiana. There are over 20, and we have had personal contact with 17 of them. We work through their offices. We help them. We do workshops in conjunction with them. We work with their membership who have some needs. We'll often come and talk to the folks right there at the offices of the chambers. So we have a great relationship, and the chambers help promote what we do because it's a service for their members. We also work with bankers in this area who are dealing with small business loans, and they love it when somebody comes with a good idea, but they need a little help with their business plan, and they make the referrals to of the client to Contact Score, and we help them put their business plan together so they fare a little bit better when the loan review committee meets.
Mm-hmm. If anybody has any questions, if they'd like to find out more about SCORE, and particularly the SCORE chapter here in Northwest Indiana, how can they find out more, Jim?
Well, there's two things to do. One, the National SCORE website is probably the best, mm-hmm. and it's just score.org. I mean, it's very simple, and you go to that, and you say, I would like to find a mentor. And you click on that, it asks you to put in your zip code. You put in the zip code. If you're in the five counties, it comes directly to us. So then we review that, and we assign it to the right person. And that's probably the premier, and there's information about SCORE, what they do, where the information is. It is one of the best websites for free information any business person's ever going to find. You go to score.org, go to publications and library, and there is a plethora of information on all topics from business finances to loans to marketing and sales to manufacturing to inventory management, all available free. And by the way, that is something about SCORE. We provide all of our services and work with all clients for no cost. I mean, we're all volunteers. We do it because we like to do it.
Well, Jim, thank you much for the information, and the best of luck to the SCORE organization here in Northwest Indiana, and the help that they offer through their volunteer mentors and helping businesses in all phases of their particular business. If they have questions, we appreciate you talking about it today.
Okay, well, it's great, and we're available anytime. Been around for 64 years and expect to be around for more.
That's great to hear. Jim Hubbard is the immediate chapter chairman and currently the secretary for SCORE, which is the nation's premier and largest volunteer network of business mentors. The first Tuesday after Thanksgiving is known as Charitable Tuesday. It's a day that's really dedicated to giving back rather than consuming, even though it's so close to Thanksgiving Day. But to find out more about how we can take advantage properly of Giving Tuesday, let's talk to Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. Thank you for joining us as always today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Giving Tuesday and why it's important, or Charitable Tuesday, I guess it's known as that too, why it's so important and some of the things we need to know so that we make the right decisions, we don't lose so much money on our taxes, and get to take advantage of how we're using the funds.
Well, I think first and foremost, the understanding the new tax laws and some of the changes are making things a little bit more challenging to qualify your charitable distributions or contributions or donations because of the way the tax structure is. So in the past, a lot of folks could get into itemized deduction. It's just going to prove a little bit more difficult now with the standard deduction as high as it is. So while we all still want to give, you know, instead of just saying, hey, you know, we don't get the deduction as much, there are unique things that you can do based on your certain situation.
Wait, you talk about knowing the tax laws better, and they're very confusing to say the least, and got even more so here with the new tax laws that took effect. What are some of the things that we really do need to understand?
So when it comes to just the charitable or itemized deductions, because charitable generally, you know, constitutes a big part of that, fewer taxpayers are going to be able to benefit from itemizing under the new tax laws. And that's just simply because, Chris, the way they're changing the standard deduction, you know, where you used to be, you know, at a $15,000-plus standard deduction, they now have bumped that up, especially if you're over age 65, to $26,500. So for those folks that are in retirement, it's going to prove a lot more difficult to get into an itemized situation. And so when you look at a contribution that you make to a charitable organization, to a church, to a particular cause, the only way that that's going to benefit you on your tax return is if in fact your itemized deductions pass the standard. Otherwise, they're giving it to you already.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there's something that's out there that maybe people may be aware of by another name, but QCD is the abbreviation for it. What are QCDs, and how are they especially helpful at this time of year with the changes in the tax laws?
So specifically, it's an opportunity for folks that are in the required minimum distribution phase of their life, which is those that are, you know, have attained the age of 70 and a half and they have qualified money. So prior laws would allow, you know, to get to an itemized, again, it wouldn't take much. You could count state tax, property taxes, charitable gifts, interest. Now they've capped a lot of those, specifically, you know, capping state and local taxes, you know, minimizing the amount of interest that you can use, having to be the first. So when you have a charitable contribution for a lot of families, unless they do considerable charitable contributions, typically they're not going to push them over that threshold of that $26,500 that is now the standard deduction for somebody in that age group. So if you have a required minimum distribution, the law allows you to make that distribution directly to a charitable organization. Doesn't have to be for the whole amount. As long as you are in qualified required minimum distribution stage of your life, you can do $1 or up to $100,000 directly from your IRA to a charitable organization or cause that you have, and it will also satisfy your required minimum distributions.
Yep. And it's quite, there's certain qualifications, like you say, that you have to face. And if you want to take advantage of that, you have to, I guess, be able to put it to your IRA. It's very important that you keep it to that.
Yeah, so the simple way to look at it is, let's say at a $4,000 required minimum distribution, I might give, let's say, to my church over the course of a year, $4,000. And when I give that to my tax person, the $4,000 doesn't help me exceed the $26,500. But if I take a check directly from my IRA, get it made out to my church, that $4,000 is then noted on its return as a qualified QCD, a qualified charitable distribution, mm-hmm. and it doesn't ever become part of your income. So in essence, you get the deduction at that point.
That's interesting. It's and all because the laws have changed, I guess. Or could you do something like this in the past, but it's just more important to follow things through because of the new laws?
You hit it right on the head. It's something that's been around for a while. I think about, well, it doesn't matter the years. It was prior to the new tax law.
Right.
But essentially wasn't as relevant because a lot of folks would hit the itemized deductions, and in which case their charitable contributions would count the same way.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about matters involving your money and your investments and the like. And conversations like this always come up through the year. But you'd say it's very important to take advantage of the opportunity when you get friends and family members, especially together for the holidays, to be able to sit down and talk about some of these issues. Tell us why this is a good time. You wouldn't think so, but why this would be a good time to talk about this.
Well, I think the first obvious one is most of the holidays when you get together, the majority of the family is going to be there, if not everybody. So if you're going to discuss something that's important, you know, that you feel is critical to your overall planning process or concerns that you have about some of the things that you're doing or parents are doing or siblings are doing or children are doing, I mean, it's you obviously have all the parties involved in one location. And hopefully, you know, you can address it and communicate and be transparent about the discussions.
Is it especially important, too, because, like you say, you'll have everybody together. It may not be a real pleasant topic to bring up, but you might have to bring these things up, like estate planning, you know. Nobody wants to think about what's going to happen after you pass away, but, you know, it's something you got to think about.
Well, and you hit it right in the head, because here's the challenge. If you don't talk about it, what typically is going to happen is, you know, you're going to end up losing parts of the estate that really you don't need to, and more importantly, there's a lot of, you know, specific family items or heirlooms or things that maybe certain members of the family want, others don't, and, you know, as a parent, you might have a certain desire for one child to have something that another doesn't, and to clarify all that at the level of the giver, as opposed to after the fact, will often save a lot of stress with siblings or family members. You know, because it becomes more about the money when it really shouldn't have to be.
I suppose, too, here again, it's talking about an unpleasant topic, but it's about tax returns and how to properly plan for all the information that you have to file, especially with the changes and everything.
Absolutely. And it even goes beyond that, Chris, into, like, documents. We have something we call the Family Estate Organizer that we put together for our clients. You know, I always tell my clients it's important information. The kids need to know it, but you don't want them to know until they have to know, type of thing. You know, so being able to take an inventory and organize all of the important things that are going to be necessary, and it goes down to simple things. Where do they locate the titles? You know, is there a safety deposit box? You know, where are all the accounts? I mean, if you've talked to anybody that's ever had to settle an estate, the mystery part of it always is, have I thought of everything? Did I get to everything that mom and dad had? and it becomes stressful, very stressful.
Yeah. And speaking of stressful things, if you don't have the conversations, people aren't aware of such things as retirement and not only planning for retirement, or we talk about this all the time, of course, but thinking about how to set up your retirement plan, retirement income plan, but also if you have to deal with all the changes you make when you start drawing Social Security, I imagine.
Absolutely, and retirement planning now has got some very unique, I should say income planning, has some very unique opportunities with the new tax laws, where you determine the source of your income based on the various accounts or sources that you have directly determines what part of your Social Security is going to be reportable or be taxable. So you can be very proactive in how you're planning. When you're working, you don't have that luxury, right? You're not going to tell your employer, pay me less so I pay less taxes. That's crazy. But in retirement, you have the opportunity to direct sources of revenue, and understanding the impact of those sources could directly result in paying a lot more taxes that you don't need to.
Are we finding that a lot of these conversations have to come about here because there are things that are going to actually take effect with the next income tax return that you have to file?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now, if you haven't had the opportunity to look at the impact of the new tax laws, you have a window here through the end of the year that you really need to take advantage of and talk to somebody that's proactive in planning as opposed to just preparation. You know, most of us, when we go get our taxes done, it's like, here's what happened last year, tell me what I owe, balance the books.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a proactive look at things is going to allow you to change the input and hopefully create strategies to reduce the tax implications. And so that's why it's so important to look at, especially with the opportunity I feel with this new tax law that's in place, there's more of an opportunity than we'll probably ever see again in our lifetimes just because of, you know, where debt is and the budget, and eventually taxes will have to go back up.
Well, maybe not right after the turkey dinner is finished. You know, that's not the time to talk with people about important things. They're usually going to fall asleep, but there is a time now, I guess, during the holidays that you do have to get together and talk about these issues and make sure that you go into 2019 with certainly your eyes open, but better prepared to be sure. We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And as always, Greg, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Indiana legalized the use of CBD or cannabis oil this year, and with improved access to the substance, more seniors are trying it to relieve pain and to treat chronic illness. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that recipients and healthcare providers say it's still hard for the hemp extract to shake off the stigma.
Cannabidiol, or CBD, was something Carol Rector had heard about and thought maybe it could help her husband, but it wasn't legal.
So, you know, I just kept watching and waiting and studying.
Her husband, Jim Rector, is 74 years old. He has diabetes. And Carol's read emerging evidence that shows CBD can treat the chronic disease. When Indiana legalized its use, Carol got it for Jim and told his doctor.
He said, let's do an A1C. So they took his blood work and it came back perfect.
Jim also suffers from chronic pain related to bursitis, and Carol says,
at this point, his pain has gone from like a 10 down to a 5.
And it doesn't only help Jim.
It helps me because I see somebody that has hope now.
Indiana was one of the last states to legalize CBD, an extract from the hemp plant. Carol and Jim purchase it at Davidson Greenhouse in Crawfordsville.
From 10 milligrams each all the way up.
Owner Mark Davidson is a self-described plantsman.
I said, if this ever becomes legal in Indiana, I'm going to sell it out the front door of my store because I know this can help so many other people.
He says marijuana and hemp are different.
Just as every sisters that I know, they're very different sisters. And the hemp plant does not have very much THC, and it has a very high level of CBD.
CBD sold in Indiana has to be manufactured with less than 0.3% THC, the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. But Carol says some seniors still stigmatize CBD.
You know, you tell some people, you know, I put Jim on CBD oil. They're like, oh, you know, he's going to get high, you know. No, he's not. This is for medicinal purposes.
Dr. Dan Stock is a family medicine practitioner in Noblesville. He prescribes CBD for some patients with neurological or immunological disorders. He explains how receptors in the endocannabinoid system work.
When that system becomes deranged, then the transmitting cell just keeps sending signals and yelling and yelling, and it tends to make the receiving cell become hyperactive. And so CBD can normalize that system without ever making it hyperactive.
Stock says it's effective for conditions related to aging.
If a lady comes into me with postmenopausal anxiety and depression because of hormone deficiency, then I'm going to recommend she use CBD as a thing she can try to get this under control.
It took Indiana lawmakers years to approve the use of CBD for medicinal purposes. Every year, numerous scientists testified the substance is safe, effective, it has no side effects, it's not addictive, and it doesn't get you high. Jeff Staker leads Hoosier Veterans for Medical Cannabis. At the VFW in Kokomo, Staker has stacks of books about cannabis and health benefits. The past few years, he watched the debate on CBD.
I think I was really frustrated because you hear the same story over and over again, and you think, what is up with these politicians not listening?
Staker says senior vets were difficult to convince, too. But now, they're even in support of measures to legalize medical marijuana.
Some of the senior officers, and they took me aside afterwards, and he said, you know what, 2 years ago, I would have never thought that I would have voted this way. But you've opened up our eyes, and you've educated us.
Lawmakers will study that issue next month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, over the air at 89.1 and online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Soundbites is sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase. This season, we've been looking at a big, overarching question. What exactly is Hoosier ingenuity? Can we put our finger on what makes Indiana the source of so many advances in science, technology, engineering, math, and medicine? In this episode, we'll meet one of today's inventors, and maybe his story will shed some light on this question. In 2017, Aaron Pierce, a Hoosier entrepreneur, was called to present at the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization, headquartered in Montreal, Quebec, about drones, unmanned aircrafts. He was the only person representing a small startup company. The other presenters? Boeing, NASA, and the country of France. How did Aaron Pierce, the head of a bootstrapped Hoosier startup, end up in a room with some of the most powerful aviation interests in the world? Aaron comes from an Air Force family and has always had a fascination with flying. As a young man, he did not consider a career in aviation, though he did volunteer for the Indiana Air Search and Rescue and flew in veteran shows. Instead, he pursued the humanities. He studied creative writing as an undergraduate at IUPUI, and then entered its master's program in geography. There, he experimented with technology like GIS, Geographic Informational Systems, and was intrigued by the new technology. In 2015, IUPUI created a new drone research center for remote sensing called the CAUSI, Center for Aerial Unmanned Systems Imaging. The center was created to find non-military uses for unmanned aircrafts, like measuring water quality and mosquito mapping. Aaron immediately got involved, and because he was the only person in the organization with an aviation background, he got to write the operations manual for this brand new organization. Aaron knew about drones before this time, but he had never worked with them directly. As soon as he started, he was hooked, deciding to create his own drone startup, which he called Pierce Aerospace. Aaron's dream is to help create the first comprehensive system to identify various types of drones. He explained that very soon in the future, this type of identification will be integral to our everyday lives. In the near future, there will be more drones than ever before, and it will become important to know if the drone in your front yard is a pizza delivery, a bill collector, or a dangerous object. It is this idea that brings us back to where we began, with Aaron Pierce presenting to the United Nations, surrounded by some of the most powerful companies and nations in the world. The UN's International Civil Aviation Organization had sent out a white paper asking for submissions of possible solutions to the problem of drone identification. It is part of the UN's larger goal to have an international registry of all unmanned aircrafts. And Pierce Aerospace's proposal beat out huge aviation companies, countries, and even NASA. After Pierce Aerospace was announced as the best solution, Aaron was called to Montreal headquarters to present the idea. Aaron has combined his passion for aviation, new technology, and the humanities to create a company that's going where few people have gone before. Attempting to standardize drone identification in a highly unregulated field where many groups are experimenting, creating, and flying drones. Aaron joins a long line of Hoosier aviation innovation, from Wilbur Wright, who was born near Hagerstown, to the early flight tests in Northwest Indiana, to the aeronautics developed at Purdue and Rose Hulman, and the generations of astronauts born and educated in the Hoosier state. It's worth considering how each of these innovations builds on the previous one, how over time a culture of innovation and a network of specialists and experts develops in a particular place. We might ask how public institutions like Purdue and IUPUI have played a role in this. Purdue introduced aerodynamics as a field of study all the way back in 1920. And now IUPUI has built upon the aviation innovation in Indiana to create pathways for the aviation of the future. More than 100 years after Octave Chanute tested early flying machines at the Indiana Dunes in 1896, a young dreamer like Aaron Pierce can take advantage of the expertise and connections that have accrued here in the Hoosier State as he starts a new business and attempts to solve the new challenges of our drone-filled future. What does Aaron's story tell us about innovation and invention? And what does it tell us about Indiana? If you have thoughts on either of those questions, send it to sbertin@indianahumanities.org. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by J.P. Morgan Chase, and I'm Sandra Burton.
With another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Gloria Tui, founder and headmistress of the Indiana Ballet Theater. I'm sorry, I'm not thinking of the correct, most professional way of saying your title and your accolades, Gloria. But welcome back.
Thank you.
It's that time of year when we're talking about Christmas programming. And Indiana Ballet Theater has famously performed at the Star Plaza Theater, the Nutcracker, for 20 years.
Yes.
And now where have you gone? Now where are you going? And how many performances would you do at each year, Gloria, at the Star Plaza?
Usually 4 performances to each day, 2 days.
And now you're having to do...
Now we have 12.
12. Performances. 3 weekends worth.
Yes.
In three different locations. Wow. And, of course, if you take all of those performances and add them up, will they equal the number of seats that you were accustomed
to? Close to. I mean, we were selling 6,000 before or more.
Right.
I don't know if we'll make it to 6,000, but we'll see.
Well, so first of all, you have the challenge of getting your audience to remember where they're going. No, I get that. Yeah, because...
Well, the one positive was the schools, the school field trips. They sold out in 2 weeks.
Really?
A few phone calls and we had it filled.
Wow.
Yes.
Good. Oh, that's
all three venues. So.
And those are in the daytime?
Those are in the daytime, yeah.
But the evening performances are...
Yes.
Are the school performances part of the 12?
Yes.
Okay. So you're going to be performing the first weekend at Crown Point High School?
Yes.
Second weekend, Valparaiso High School.
Yes.
And finally, third weekend at Indiana University Northwest.
Yes.
In the New Arts and Sciences building.
Yes.
We'll be calling it the New Arts and Sciences building until we retire, won't we? I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, those are all really nice places to perform.
They are, yes.
They are.
Still with challenges, you know.
Well, you were telling me that it was difficult to cast the ballet.
Very difficult, yes, because most of the either people work in the day or go to school in the day, so it was limited as who could perform in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to end up having these three casts that are split sharing costumes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that is tough. So you always had the same cast in the past?
We did, yes.
Yeah, you could do that.
Yes, because they only had two shows to do in the day.
Mm-hmm.
But with this many shows to do in the day.
Mm-hmm. We did we did four performances of our children's education concerts recently with Northwest Indiana Symphony instead of just the two that we used to do. And we did two in Highland and two in Valpo.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we had a classical concert that week. And it was very difficult for us to hire musicians who were available for all those rehearsals and performances. And a lot of them come from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were having to spend the night, you know, pay to spend the night. Yeah, it was.
I didn't
even think of those issues. Yeah. I was just thinking of my side of it, selling
tickets.
Well,
fortunately, I've got a very large house.
Mm-hmm.
And I have more or less an apartment on my upper floor. So all of these dancers come in and stay with me. But if it weren't for that, we wouldn't be able to have them because we have them coming in from Chicago, Michigan, and Florida.
And you have over 150 in your cast.
Right.
That's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of coordinating.
Yes.
Let alone choreography.
And the costumes that they have to share, you know, how many names on each costume.
Boy.
You know, making sure you take the right costumes to the right venue.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's exciting, though. Well, so the public can take advantage of these performances beginning November 30th, that weekend and the next two weekends.
Yes.
And they can get tickets online.
They can get tickets online, brown paper tickets.
Brown paper tickets.
Yes. Or they can go to our website and find out all of the information they need.
Mm-hmm. So this is the performance, or they are the performances, of the Nutcracker for Northwest Indiana.
Yes.
Well, you're to be commended, Gloria, to persevering. And how well you do it next year? You're waiting to see how it goes.
This is the thing. You have to kind of book now for next year. But we don't know how this year is going before we can make a decision. So that's a tough one.
Well, it's coming up. You'll know soon enough.
Yeah.
Well, Gloria, good luck.
Yes.
Take a deep breath.
Yes.
And you can enjoy the holidays afterwards.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for being here, Gloria.
Thank you
for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts conversations online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, a conversation with one of Northwest Indiana's new state representatives, Chris Chung.